It's showtime.
Okay, Tokyo,
South America,
Australia,
France,
Germany,
UK,
Africa.
Here we go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Here we go, off and running on this 18th day of May 2022, well over halfway through the month of May, running downhill to the horn end. Everything is coming along nicely for that, by the way. It is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. Oh, yes. Who knows what we'll find as we delve into the depths of the religion industry. It's just who and what they are, right? Oh, hi, I'm Robin. And every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, and so we send out thanks this evening to our 18th day of the month subscribers. And that means thanks to our dear friend down in the South Pacific. And thank you to Charlene in Rogues Island. And thank you to Grace. Thank you to Joy in Ann Arbor. Thank you, Cecilia. That was yesterday, but still, thank you, Cecilia. And so where we find ourselves... Oh, goodness me. What was the number last night as we came to the close of the program? We went from, so it's like $1,600, I think. And that's a hell of a hole. And I hope we can fill it in some, please. Because for some reason or another, I can't convince Appalachian Power that they need to leave the lights on based on my good looks. Oh, well, there we go. But if you want to help out, the PayPal button's over at headon.live. Or you can use the old email address. If you just go direct to PayPal, use Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. That still works. I just don't put it out there a lot because it is proving devilishly difficult to make Bob go away. But it does work that way. And Venmo's good too. Yeah. Like I said, it's prayer meeting Wednesday, and why not? Oh God, do we go with the obvious stuff, or do we do a little prayer meeting Wednesday fun just to get things started? It's always such a conundrum. Let's do stupid religion stuff. Because it is, you know, prayer meeting Wednesday. Right? Yeah. Why not? I'm in kind of a quiet and contemplative mood today. I don't know why. I think there are things that aren't actually alive outside that are blooming and creating pollen right now. I've been And I don't mean for emotional reasons. I've been teary-eyed all day, sneezing my head off, and felt it, and just, ugh. And it is, of course, rather brutally warm in the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion, because of course it is. But, you know, we talk a lot about American history here, and history in general. And one of the critical determining factors. Okay, Lee in New York. Good looks and power. Lee says, if good looks was the justification for me having electricity, I'd be sitting in the dark. Yeah, kind of. It's the same. Yeah. Base made for radio, y'all. But no, I get it. Don't be so damn hard on yourself, Lee. No, what I was saying, the thing about history is you have to at least make a passing attempt at being honest, or else it's not history. You know, that's the whole thing that. That's the whole thing that encompasses the so-called critical race theory debate. History is not pleasant. History can be fascinating to study, but it's not all sunshine and unicorns and butterflies and I don't know, strawberry shortcake and rainbow bright and My Little Pony. It's ugly, it's bloody, it's messy. It often shows us at our worst, and some people at their best. And so if your history only makes you feel good, it's probably not history. Maybe it's mythology or legend or hagiography, but it ain't history. And yet there's a clown out there, a very wealthy, dangerous clown, an inveterate and pathological liar by the name of David Barton. And we've talked about him in the past. And he just makes crap up and calls it American history. Well, it being prayer meeting Wednesday, we've got him in a pulpit here because he's touring the country right now. Because he's trying to get out the good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual, Christian Republican vote with something called faith wins. Yes. And at faith wins events, he does what he always does. He lies his ass off. Take, for instance, this. It's about voting and elections and American, not history.
In the early days of America, what was the voter engagement by churches?
Voter engagement by churches. Well, first off, churches ran the communities.
Did you hear that?
So churches ran the communities, and the voter turnout was 100%. And that was for at least 70 years. When Daniel Webster ran for Congress, there were 5,000 voters in his district. 5,000 votes were cast. Now, he got 4,990, so the other guy must have been him and his family has all voted for him. But nonetheless, it was...
Ho, ho, ho!
Still 100% turnout. We felt like that was a duty we would answer to God for, and that was really...
Yeah, we, because David Barton was back there in 1824 when Daniel Webster was running for Congress. Did you know, by the way, that one of the first times Daniel Webster, that someone tried to hire Daniel Webster as a lawyer, was to promote the idea of New Hampshire seceding from the Union? Fascinating, the things you learn when you're not David Barton.
High turnout. Churches ran it.
Yeah, no. And thanks to our friends at Right Wing Watch for that clip. You know, I've said a million times, I don't know how the people who work there and pull these clips manage to just stay either sane or sober. But David Barton is a miserable liar. Because there's actual data out there that proves him a liar. One, churches did not run the communities. Government, local government ran the communities. And Barton refers to the first 70 years. Those first 70 years were, well, if you go from the date of the ratification of the Constitution, 1787, so he's talking about he's basically talking about up into the 1850s. And I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but even if there was higher turnout, it's because not a hell of a lot of people could vote. The women sure weren't voting. Enslaved Americans, black folks, men or women, weren't voting. The indigenous population wasn't voting. White dudes who didn't happen to own enough property to qualify for a vote weren't voting. And by the way, the church was just fine with that. But in point of fact, you can put the lie to a nasty little liar like David Barton simply by looking to another election, not Daniel Webster's in 1824. No. How about 1789? 2 years after the ratification of the Constitution. When James Madison ran against James Monroe for a seat in the Congress. Half of the white male property owning qualified voters in the Old Dominion, Virginia, didn't bother to vote. And so James Madison actually won that election, 1,308 votes to James Monroe, to 972 for James Monroe. And there were, meanwhile, 5,189 voters in that district. But this doesn't matter to a godforsaken liar like David Barton. He's in the business of trying to transform what remains of our popular government into a straight-up theocracy. And it's funny that that clip actually comes from the Truth Baptist Church of Mechanicsville, Virginia. You know, he told that lie about 100% voter participation in a commonwealth that where half the people didn't show up to vote between James Madison and James Monroe in 1789. Oh, where's a vengeful, bearded, juvenile delinquent in the sky with a handful of lightning bolts when you need one, right? God. And he does all this with a straight face because he knows that there's nobody there to challenge him. Yeah. So yesterday was a big primary day, Pennsylvania. Wait a minute. Sorry. Let's all have a giggle. North Carolina, Stan, where attendee of apparently multiple cocaine-fueled sex parties, and I got to give him credit. He's got cute taste in black lace bras. Madison Cawthorn. Got primaried. And got beat. And he's having a big sad today. Oh, and by the way, along the way, John Fetterman he won the primary. He won the primary in Pennsylvania. He will be the Democratic nominee for Senate. And a speedy recovery to him. But also in Pennsylvania, a genuine, no doubt about it, maggot nutcase, Doug Mastriano, is going to be the nominee for governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that's a bad thing. That's a really bad thing. Because he is, and I don't want to put too fine a point on this, crazier than a sprayed roach at a decon party. Or a raid rave. A real Lulu. In fact, over at CNN, their conservative commentator, Anna Navarro, I mean, remember, she's a Republican, y'all, but she's one of those Republicans that we're willing to sort of hold hands with a little bit because she's anti-Trump. And so it was that in a segment that she was called upon to discuss Doug Mastriano, Doug Mastriano, we got this.
Navarro and CNN political analyst Ron Brownstein, welcome to you both. Anna, let me start with you. Your big takeaway from the primary races last night.
Well, I don't think there's one takeaway, right? Because there's really something for anybody. There's some where Trump won, there's some where Trump lost. But I will tell you probably the big takeaway is that if you are a moderate kind of centrist middle of the roader in either party, you are having a very hard time in these primary races. Because what we saw on the Democratic side in places like Oregon, with Schroeder, who had been endorsed by President Biden and was a moderate, with Conor Lamb, who had every Democratic establishment endorsement you can think of in Pennsylvania and was supposed to be this tailor-made candidate for Pennsylvania. And they both got shellacked.
Yeah, well, I mean, isn't that damning with faint praise where John Fetterman's concerned? He's been running his ass off. He ran a good campaign. And Conor Lamb, he's been lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania for 4 years. It is four, isn't it? And he has showed himself to be courageous, bold, fearless in his discharge of his duties. And Conor Lamb lost a partial term election in Western PA, won his own congressional term, and wasn't content to sit there and be grateful to the people who sent him to office, and instead decided that after 2 years he was senatorial. I would have been proud as punch to vote for John Fetterman. You know, I hope, I mean, of course, I'm just, you know, I'm baby Tran. I've only been in transition for 18 months. But I feel a sense of loyalty to those who are loyal to me. And John Fetterman has never been afraid to stand up and speak out for the LGBTQIA plus community. I mean, he really pissed off the maggots in Pennsylvania one day when he unfurled a rainbow flag. Woo! God! So, but then again, I love it when Republicans analyze Democratic politics. Because a moderate, you got to remember what a moderate Republican like Anna Navarro really is. Here's the hint. Still a Republican. She wants a Democratic Party that's Republican light because it's always so much easier to beat Republican light than it is to beat an actual Democrat. Yeah, so let's let her continue.
Yesterday by progressive candidates. And on the Republican side, you have McCormick, who is the establishment candidate, duking it out for his life. If he wins, he owes it to Kathy Barnett, who siphoned votes off of Mehmet Oz. If Mehmet Oz wins, he owes it to Donald Trump. So what I saw was on both sides of the aisle, moderates are getting squeezed out of primaries.
Hmm. Ron, let's turn to the Republican primary for governor in Pennsylvania. Yeah. The nominee, Doug Mastriano. That wasn't even close, though. I mean, yes, the right. Second and third candidates, they probably split the moderate vote. But for Republicans in the state who say that he is too extreme, he's too far out to win general, how do you win the primary by such a large margin?
Well, it's the changing composition of the Republican electorate. I mean, you know, that second place candidate, Lou Barletta, ostensibly, you're saying the more moderate alternative, he came to notice as a hardline anti-immigrant policies, both as a mayor in Pennsylvania, later as a member of Congress, was one of the first Republican members of Congress to endorse Donald Trump. I mean, you see the evolution of the Republican electorate in these races. And I'm very much with David Chalian. I mean, the issue isn't so much who Donald Trump endorsed. The issue is who endorsed Donald Trump. I mean, you saw all of the major candidates so far in all the Republican primaries running in the Trump mold. And in part, they are doing that because Trump has changed the basis of the Republican electorate. It's a process that began before him, but has accelerated under him. It's moved away from white collar, suburban, more culturally moderate, economically conservative voters toward more rural, blue collar, religiously devout voters. Mastriano certainly identifies to a ominous extent with themes of Christian nationalism. And so the problem that the forces in the Republican Party who are critical of Trump's directions face is that Trumpism is kind of self-perpetuating in that the voters who are most uneasy about it are less likely to participate. And the electoral basis for an alternative approach is eroding in the Republican Party, as we are seeing in these primaries.
Anna, let's listen to the Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano, here.
They'd like to call people who stand on the Constitution far right and extreme.
You might want to get the hockey puck for this. Just saying.
Repudiate that. That is crap. That is absolutely not true. On day one, any jab for job requirements are gone. On day one, CRT is over. On day one, you can only use the bathroom that your biology anatomy says.
And the polls show people care about gas prices, food prices, inflation, the economy. Why is that his message? I mean, I know he's speaking to his people, but this is the turn toward the general now.
Because I think that's who he is. I think because he's being authentic as to the right-wing nutcase that he is. He sounds like a commentator on Fox News, not like somebody wanting to be governor of a state that until now has been, you know, pretty purple. So I think he was sticking to his points that won him the primary, and it is what he's going to run on. CRT, culture wars, manufactured grievances, and things that he thinks get his base out. It was one of the looniest, wackiest acceptance speeches I've ever heard.
You know, almost as though it had been written by Kimberly, the best is yet to come, Gargoyle.
But that's what they want in their candidates.
CRT, gone.
Well, okay, it's never been anywhere except, you know, graduate degree programs. Just saying. But, you know, he sits up nights worrying about where people go potty. Because he's a goddamn weirdo. I don't know if he says, well, I don't know. I mean, he's going to, I hope the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania have the common good sense not to send him to the governor's mansion. But meanwhile, as noted, young Maddie Cawthorn is having a sad.
There have been several photos and videos of you circulating online on social media recently. What can you say to those constituents who maybe have lost some confidence in you and are looking for some other kind of leadership?
You know what, I'll tell you, there's been a coordinated strike carried out by really kind of the old establishment wing of our party. And
you mean, wait, the old establishment wing of his party? The ones that he used to respect, who invited him to coke-fueled sex parties? Was it the old establishment wing of the Republican Party that put that bra on him? Honey, own it! Slay queen!
The closet is a fine and quiet place, but none, I think, do their embrace. And you know what the worst part of this is? He's not going to be unemployed for very long. He'll hold his seat until January of 2023. God, you know, we're not even to summer yet, and we're talking about it. Sometimes I absolutely despise the fact that we can't just kind of live in the moment for a minute. But he'll keep his seat until January 2023, unless he, I don't know, gets a job as a cocaine-fueled sex party planner. But apparently this is his modus operandi. He even lied about why he wound up in the wreck that paralyzed him. Lied about an appointment to a service academy. Oh, well.
It's a loser's mentality. They realize the direction the country's going in, the direction that the population's going in. And if they want to be able to pay off people from my past and try and bring up old pictures or things that happened years and years ago, I feel free to let them do that.
It's not just that it's old pictures and things. It's you talking about cocaine-fueled sex parties on some... Oh, what was the Morning Glory Moral Volcano and Battle Cry of Freedom or whatever it was? Nobody did that to him. Nobody fired him up with sodium pentothal and made him to do that. Do. No. That was entirely on him. But, you know, before he announced that, you know, conceded the race.
Oh, you know what? The thing that I love about President Trump is that when you get your back pushed up against the wall, I've found that most people in politics, if it's not...
Is that how they got the black lace bra on you, sweetie? Pushed your back up against the wall? Up against the wall, you redneck mothers. Sorry, I'm just having entirely too much fun with this.
Politically expedient to them, they'll turn your back on you in a heartbeat. Yeah. But no matter what you are facing... When Donald Trump has your back, he has your back to the end, and that is why he's going
to win. Oh, somebody wants a job at Truth Social. Like I said, he's not going to be unemployed for very long. And you know, if Donald Trump flips him that black, another black lace bra, he'll have it on in a second. It's okay, Maddie. We see you. You're valid. Sorry. Maybe I shouldn't do that, but it's hard to resist when you consider that the Republican Party is filled to the brim with transphobes and homophobes and creeps like Dan Bishop of North Carolina, who got taken to the woodshed in a congressional hearing. The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing today to talk about the leaked Supreme Court opinion that will take away full citizenship from every woman in the United States and every person capable of being pregnant. Yeah, you know what? You're right, Matt. Matt in San Francisco says of Maddie, and it happened years ago. Matt says, the "it happened years ago" argument loses some steam when you're only 24. Just saying. Just agreeing. Just cowbelling. Yeah. Oh, and meanwhile, Doug Maggot Astriano and Steve in New York says, subject line, crap. Is that some sort of legal, political, constitutional term of art I've not heard of? Oh, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a term of art. Ah, you know, and if he gets really mad, he'll say it's dookie. Yeah. Wonder if Doug Maggot Astriano has a swimming pool, because somebody should throw a Baby Ruth in it. Duty! Caddyshack. Sorry. So anyway, at this hearing, which was about, like I said, the leaked Supreme Court opinion, they had a witness on, an abortion provider from, of all places, Talabama, Dr. Yashika Robinson, testifying about the necessity of women's reproductive rights and women's reproductive care and a woman's right to privacy. But Dan Bishop apparently didn't get the memo of what the hearing was about. Instead, he asked Dr. Robinson, because apparently Dan Bishop of North Carolina, Stan, is pals with 3X Marsha. And Dan's confused, and Dan doesn't know what a woman is. So, you know, ask a doctor, right? 4 out of 5 doctors, yeah. Suffice to say, it did not go well for Dan Bishop. Well, let's see here. Take it away, Danny boy.
So, Dr. Robinson, I noticed in your written testimony, you said that you use she, her pronouns. You're a medical doctor. What's a woman?
It's important for you to understand why I said I use she, her pronouns.
Well,
it's because
I was explaining why I'm asking the question, but I just thought you could answer the question. What's a woman?
I think it's important that we educate people like you.
Ow! It's important that we educate people like you. You know, stupid, bigoted, reveling in your ignorance and your hate. Forgive me. I want to hear that again.
I'm asking the question, but I'd just like to get an answer to the question. What's a woman?
I think it's important that we educate people like you about why we're doing the things that we do. And so the reason that I use she and her pronouns is because I understand that there are people who become pregnant that may not identify that way. And I think it is discriminatory to speak to people or to call them in such a way as they desire not to be called.
Thanks for that.
So it's important that we respect each individual person.
Are you going to answer my question? Can you answer the question, what's a woman?
I'm a woman. And I will ask you, which pronouns do you use?
Can you
if you tell me that you use she and her pronouns, I'm going to answer you. I'm going to call you Mr. Bishop. I'm going to respect you for how you want me to address you.
I'm just saying, so you give me an example of a woman. You say that you are a woman. Can you tell me, otherwise, can you tell me what a woman is?
Yes, I'm telling you, I'm a woman.
Is that as comprehensive a definition as you can give me?
That's as comprehensive as a definition as I will give you today. I think that it's important that we focus on what we're here for, and it's to talk about access to abortion care.
So you're not interested in answering a question I asked you.
Danny boy. First law of holes, honey. When you're in one, stop digging. She's so much more intelligent than you, Danny boy. Frankly, if you were to add up your IQ and the IQs of every goddamned human being in North Carolina who voted for you, Danny boy, you would still be orders of magnitude short on IQ points as compared to Dr. Robinson. Poor, you could almost muster up a little bit of sympathy for these goddamn Republicans, because they've had their asses handed to them time after time after time by brilliant black women, and they keep coming back for more. Hit me again and put a little stank on it. Kind of feel sad for Mrs. Congressman Bishop, if there is one. Honey, what's a woman? Oh, come here, baby. I'll show you. I look at Dan Bishop and that line that line just comes to mind. I was twice the man I was twice the man he is, and I'm twice the woman he'll ever have. But this is this is who they are, because you and I can laugh at this foolishness. But this is the stuff that gets MAGA voters all excited. They think critical race theory really is a thing. They do sit around. They sit up nights. They sit at the dinner table. They're thumbing through the hymnals at church, worrying about who's going pee pee where. And the guys are just asking themselves, what's a woman? That's what makes it so nice to be liberal, to be progressive, be a Democrat. We're not troubled by such questions. We don't lose sleep over who's going pee-pee where, as long as, it's in a bathroom somewhere. I wonder if they've heard about Amber Heard pooping on Johnny Depp's bed. Was that a woman? And why'd she go poopy on the bed? I'm not following that trial, but Annette can't put it down. What a pathetic joke on the judicial system. But oh well. Whatevs. I mean, she got Elon Musk to pay some of the charity pledges that she made, for God's sakes. Lee in New York says, Dan Bishop does not know what a woman is. This little boy does not know what a man is either, because Dan Bishop certainly doesn't behave like one. Oh, but he's brilliant. Just ask him. He'll tell you. But that hearing was a Lulu. And, you know, if you recall some of Joey's journals, you'll know that he went down to Georgia, and he has tremendous respect for Representative Lucy McBath. And she kind of showed why today in that self-same hearing in the House Judiciary Committee. What she said should be heard by every single person in America. And that's why I'm going to run it.
5 minutes. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you so much to Chairman Nadler, and thank you so much to our witnesses today. We really appreciate you being here under such duress. Like so many women in America, for years, I struggled to get pregnant. My husband and I, we tried everything that we could do to start a family of our own, and finally, we were successful. I had never been so happy, and I prayed for this moment for so many years. I wanted to tell everyone, I just wanted to shout it from all of the mountaintops. For weeks, I began to dream about our life and our future together. And then one day, I woke up covered in blood. And it's hard to describe the agony of a miscarriage. It's heartbreak. It's helplessness. It's pain. And it's profound sadness. Millions of women suffer from them, and I've heard from many who felt guilty like I did, who felt as though that we weren't worthy of having a child. Those are the same feelings that crept through my mind, and every time I've had these difficult discussions with other women, I remind them that they are strong and that they are powerful beyond measure. And that their worth is far more than their ability to procreate. However, it seems those in support of this ruling disagree. After my second miscarriage, I wondered in my grief again if God had decided I was never meant to be a mother. So when I finally got pregnant again, I was overjoyed. It was as if I believe that God was giving me and my husband, finally, he had a plan for us to be parents. But after 4 months, while feeling terror and trauma in my heart, I was rushed to the emergency room. There with my doctor and my husband, I learned that I had suffered a fetal demise or a stillbirth. There again, I was filled with anguish and sorrow and guilt, and I tried so hard, and still I felt like I failed trying to be a mother. My doctor thought it would be better and safer to end the pregnancy naturally without the medicines so commonly used. So for 2 weeks, I carried my dead fetus and waited for me to go into labor. For 2 weeks, people passed me on the street, telling me how beautiful I looked, asking how far along I was, and saying that they were so excited for me and my future with my child. For 2 weeks, I carried a lost pregnancy and the torment that comes with it. I never went into labor on my own. When my doctor finally induced me, I face the pain of labor without hope for a living child. This is my story. It's uniquely my story. And yet, it's not so unique. Millions of women in America, women in this room, women at your homes, and women you love and cherish have suffered a miscarriage. And so I ask, on behalf of these women, after which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned? Would it have been after the first miscarriage? After doctors used what would be an illegal drug to abort the lost fetus? Would you have put me in jail after the second miscarriage? Perhaps that would have been the time. Forced to reflect in confinement at the guilt I felt, the guilt that so many women feel after losing their pregnancies. Or would you have put me behind bars after my stillbirth? After I was forced to carry a dead fetus for weeks, after asking God if I was ever going to be able to raise a child, and I asked because the same medicine used to treat my failed pregnancies is the same medicine states like Texas would make illegal. I ask because if Alabama makes abortion murder, does it make miscarriage manslaughter? I ask because I want to know if the next woman who has a miscarriage at 3 months, if she will be forced to carry her dead fetus to term. So for the women in your life whose stories you do not know, for the women across the country whose lives you may not understand, and for the women in America who have gone through things you simply cannot comprehend, I say to you this: women's rights are human rights. Reproductive health care is health care. And medical decisions should be made by women and those that they trust, not politicians and officials. We have a choice. We can be the nation that rolls back the clock, that rolls back the rights of women, and that strips them of their very liberty. Or we can be the nation of choice, the nation where every woman can make her own choice. Freedom is our right to choose.
General Lady yields back.
That right there is what patriotism sounds like. Make no mistake. There's really nothing you can add to that except to, as well, I remembered her story as she was speaking. That baby for whom she yearned was gunned down by a lawful gun owner, a white guy. Just for being alive. I cannot begin to imagine the grief that attends not only every waking moment, but every sleeping moment of Representative McBath's very existence. And yet she has the strength and the courage to speak truth to power. And I wonder, of those unknown, untold stories, I wonder how many there really are in this country. I wonder. I know of two. One is my beloved ex-wife. The other is my daughter. Annette and I were on FaceTime with her when they induced her dead baby into a stillbirth. And she's not over it. Far from it. For years and years and years after we found each other and were married. Even without thinking about it, when the anniversary date rolled around, Annette would find herself just feeling awful for no known reason. And then she'd say, "What's today's date?" And I would tell her, and she'd say, "Oh, of course." Because she would know that that was the anniversary of the most hellish day of her existence. Because, see, her doctor, her butcher, forced her to carry a set of twins all the way to delivery, knowing full well that one of the babies was long since dead, and that the other one was horribly malformed and would never, ever, even with the most heroic of medical interventions, live outside the womb. But he didn't give her any alternatives. He did to her what Republican legislators want to do to every woman in this country. And no amount of prayer and no amount of love in the little fetus is going to make anything any better. She would have been far better off had she been able to be relieved of that agony. But Republicans don't care. They sincerely do not give a good goddamn, because, of course, that's all a woman is good for. Women who, by choice or by dint of physiology, are unable to bear children are literally less than garbage to the Republican Party. For as long as I've been doing this, I still find it difficult, even though I know who Republicans are, I know Republicans are just monsters, I find it extremely difficult to imagine what it must be like to have a soul so dead that you could, with no irony whatsoever, declare that that was just a woman's lot in life for having the, I guess, curse of Eve put upon her at the moment that, you know, back when she was a precious little zygote and a precious little fetus, that she was simply cursed to that existence. And they drag out their goddamn Bibles and talk about how he shall hurt thy head and ye shall wound his heel. Now, okay. You reckon the plot? You reckon the plot line for the Honeymooners comes from Genesis? But, you know, Darlene in Connecticut points out, I'll tell you, most of the Dems came out swinging in that hearing today. Jerry Bignad seemed to sleep at the damn gavel, though. Representative Dean was masterful in calling out that horrid Glenn Foster for her hypocrisy, pointing out that Frosty Foster had an abortion, and Dean thanked her for sharing her story and said she was sorry for what she went through, but then she went for the jugular by pointing out that she had a choice and no one forced Frosty Foster to have that abortion years ago, and that she has no business imposing her regret on the rest of the nation. Fucking brilliant! Dean was outpaced only by Representative Escobar and Representative McBath, whom you just heard. Representative Escobar directed her gaze right to the C-SPAN camera and said, "To my fellow Americans, make no mistake, they," meaning the Republicans, are coming for you. It was powerful indeed. And they are coming. They are. And I'm gonna ask a question here. Because this kind of punditry gets under my skin somewhat. And I realize we kind of live in a bubble here. Because we are politically aware, we are alert, we are activists, we are action-oriented. But Jake Sherman, who's a co-founder of Punchbowl News, I always found that name sort of curious. Doesn't exactly suggest, I don't know, the seriousness with which we might hope American politics would be treated. Punchbowl? Well, Jake Sherman, this afternoon on MSNBC, got into the prophecy business. Prayer meeting Wednesday is a good time to talk prophecy. But he got into the prophecy business and did everything but start measuring the drapes for the Republicans. And said that Democrats are on the verge of being drowned in a blood-red Republican tsunami come November. Of course, that's why we have to have the election. And, what he said was, I'd say right now the Republican Party, the same Republican Party that we just talked about that has not lifted a finger against Trump, is up 8 points in the generic battle in the battleground states. That means that the average unnamed Republican is beating the unnamed Democrat in crucial districts by 8 points. It means Republicans are not only winning right now in the House, which is the base of the Trump support, but they're winning overwhelmingly. So their theory of the case, let's not talk about Trump, let's not talk about January 6th, let's talk about inflation, let's talk about all these dynamics being played out on the economy, it's being proven right. Well, okay. But when you think about what Lucy McBath said today, what Representative Escobar and Representative Dean all said, it makes you wonder how many self-hating women there are in the United States. Because how can they win if every woman who understands what this nation is up against, how can any woman go out except the self-hating ones and vote and not vote Democrat and not get excited about it? And not vote like their lives depend upon it, because they do. Maybe a little less reportage on how the Democrats are bound to lose, and a little more reportage on how every woman in America is about to be reduced to second or third, if not lower, class citizenship. Maybe that ought to be the story that they're talking about around the table there on Deadline White House or whatever. Maybe. Maybe. But I could be wrong. Let's run over and talk to Paul from Parts Unknown. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm doing good, Robin. How are you?
I'm well. A little warm, but well.
Good. I finally got a break and was able to call in. It's been a while. I've just been, they've been working us really hard, and it's gardening season on the weekend. So,
oh, nice.
Not a lot of free time.
Nice, though. And by the way, the puppies are adorable.
Oh, yes, they are. We had we foster through a dog rescue, and we had two poodles, female, that we were fostering that were surrendered from a breeder. And one or both of them might have been pregnant. So we watched both of them for a month. One of them was pregnant, and she had five baby puppies about a month ago, born at our place, three boys, two girls, and their eyes are open and they're running around. So it went from, oh, they're so cute and they're napping, to they're everywhere and I can't take a step without tripping over one.
Yeah, but they're so adorable when they're in that sort of bouncy everywhere phase.
Oh, yeah. It's still tolerable now because they're at the stage where they'll play for 30 to 45 minutes, and then they will nap for 4 hours.
Aww.
So, yeah. So off to worse news. I'll give a COVID update and a general disease update in the short time that I have on this break.
Okay.
So I can just start with some facts. I hear from the site that I work at that makes part of the components for COVID test kits. One of the reasons we're so busy is that the demand for test kits is up by a lot. Like, they're preparing for needing more test kits for some reason. I can't figure out why.
It's over, isn't
and,
it? COVID's over, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. But apparently people that have money to spend on kits don't think so, because we're not making them to, like, store in a warehouse in the hopes of selling them. We are selling them to people who have given us money to make them in advance. So we're working on that. Save the one exposure we had, one positive test we had about 7 weeks ago, maybe five, I've lost track, that I was when I got exposed again for the second time and the person wasn't wearing a mask. He was the only person on the site that tested positive back in late March. Since then, we have had no positive tests from our weekly voluntary testing since then, even from last week. So Friday, we were still no positives. That was last Friday. Yesterday, there was an email from the site saying, hey, since Friday, over the weekend, we've had four positives, and it's everywhere. So it went from nothing to a huge blip, and everyone's locking down. Yesterday at the site, the percentage of people wearing masks went up as the day progressed. As the email came out, it's usually around the 20-ish%, which has been the low, and I'm part of that. And I just started suddenly seeing half the people in my lab wearing masks by the end of the day. So it's definitely coming back quickly, and we're starting to see the signals of it. And so we as in the site are starting to look at more intense precautions because it's getting in and people are staying home and we're losing staff. Because even if they're asymptomatic, we can't have them working in the lab because you can't expose the test kit components to the virus, or every test kit tests positive, whether you've got the virus or not, because it's in the kit, not in your body. So we're still being very careful. When I get news of the new protocols that they may be putting down, I'll pass that on. So those are sort of the facts. My advice is, put the mask back on. If you aren't putting it on now, get it on. This is, as far as I'm able to understand, these variants, while they may be not as severe in their symptoms and you might not have a bad reaction to it because you're vaccine boosted, it is the most contagious virus, this variant. in the modern world that I'm aware of. I could be wrong on that, but it's definitely going to be in the top three. Every time this thing mutates and gets more contagious, it gets much more contagious. The original COVID strain was like in the middle of the pack in terms of contagiousness. And then Omicron was pushing measles communicability, which is among the highest. And this stealth Omicron stuff and the other variants coming out are even more contagious than that. So take your precautions, wear the masks, and remember your vaccine, your boosting is your last line of defense, not your first line. Wear the masks, be careful, stay away from crowds, don't go to more events with 10 or more people. Don't go to more than one of those every couple weeks to make sure that you don't catch something at a big event and then go to another big event and spread it. But that's what I can advise for COVID right now. It looks like it's rolling back, and I'm not seeing the vaccination numbers to stop it. If you have children under the age of the ages of 5 to 11, like I do, and they are already double vaxxed, yesterday they just announced that they got a clear for the booster shot for 5 to 11. If your child was vaccinated in that age range 5 or more months ago, I would highly recommend getting them boosted again. That's what we're doing with my stepdaughter. She got
the second series finished up
in December.
I think you're absolutely right, Paul, especially based on, you know, the fact that the FDA cleared the booster, the Pfizer booster, for 5 to 11 yesterday. And as I've said before, I don't know why I've got such a block about it. It's not any sort of misgivings or anything. For some reason or another, I just, you know, every other time I was like, give me my booster. And, you know, I dropped by Kroger's the other day and said, you know, and they said, well, you know, if you'll just go online and fill out all the paperwork in advance, you'll save yourself about a 2-hour wait here. I've never had a 2-hour wait.
That's because just like when the first booster came out, in the early stages, when they didn't have a large enough supply to handle the instant demand for everyone that wanted it, it's going to be hard to get, I imagine, for a little bit. And then but the number of people, the percentage of people that want it is a smaller portion, like only 29% of adults are currently boosted or something like that in America. So once you roll through the people that are actively trying to get it, then it'll be easier to get. But that also means it's going to be later, which at least for children, I would not recommend. Get your kid to the front of the line would be my recommendation. That's just it. And then if we're really going off into the Paul's opinion part, there is the talk of the not encephalitis. Come on. Dang it. The disease of the liver.
Oh.
My brain's foggy.
Yeah.
Hepatitis.
Yes.
The hepatitis-like symptoms of liver damage in children that is caused by some sort of virus, possibly some form of COVID. We don't know. My opinion is it doesn't matter whether it's linked to COVID or its own separate disease. All the cases we've seen, the hepatitis isn't being caused by environmental or genetic or conditions. Everything that the pattern of the cases tells us this is some sort of communicable disease. It doesn't matter whether it's COVID or not. If it's another disease, the best way to protect it is to keep your kids safe, keep them masked up, and keep them away from people. Like general crowds and stuff. Don't take them to amusement parks and that type of thing. So I feel people are getting distracted by, hey, it's COVID. Hey, it's another disease. And it doesn't matter. Mask up.
Indeed. I know time is limited, but can I, this is tangential, but it makes sense in terms of what you do.
Yes.
You work in a lab. You understand the standards in labs. You've talked to us at length about it and explained it to us in the past. I'm watching, as many of us are, this ongoing formula shortage, baby formula shortage. And a central part of that seems to have been a screw-up at an Abbott Labs plant in Michigan. And I guess Abbott got busted repeatedly for their standards and practices. Do you have any insight into how hard it is to maintain the sterility and cleanliness in a circumstance like that?
Yes, in my lab currently for about the past 2 months, I've been working because I'm the only person, I'm only one of only two people currently trained in the lab. Everyone else is out of the lab on PTO that knows how to do it. I've been working on LDL conjugates, so low density lipoproteins, cholesterol. So I work with human plasma, and I isolate it and separate it out of the plasma, the cholesterol, and then I purify it, test it, and then I conjugate it with a variety of dyes to make products to sell to customers that are trying to come up with the next Lipitor and cholesterol-reducing drugs. So I work with that stuff daily. I have to keep it sterile. I have to package it sterile. I have to decon my bench with 10% bleach solution every day. It's a long process. It's the bleaching after everything I've, all the instruments and containers and beakers and anything I've used that's been touched, pipette tips, anything that's been touched with the LDL of the human plasma, because it can still contain viruses, diseases, and all sorts of stuff that could infect me and other people. I have to sterilize them by putting them in a bucket with 10% bleach solution and then washing them thoroughly. And I tend to wear, I have these clothes. My dad commented on it when I saw him about a month ago. He was coming a gray shirt that I had a couple of weird pink patches on that were about the size of a quarter. And he's like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Oh, this is one of my bio work shirts, because I constantly get little splashes of bleach that come through when I'm cleaning these massive buckets full of stuff, and you get it on your pants and you get it on your clothes. And so I just wear those shirts again when I do more LDL stuff, because it's already kind of a ruined shirt. So it's just a kind of a work shirt. So yeah, it's difficult. I get the cabinet I work in when I package that has to be sterile gets tested. It's called bioburden tested. They come with a swab and test for bacteria and other particles growth. And so there's so I have to be vigilant. And then there's a team that watches over me, in a sense, not every minute, but like checks in on what I'm doing to make sure that stuff is still good. It takes a lot of eyes and effort to keep things sterile, because life finds a way.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why we're here, right? Life finds a way. I just wonder how long it's going to take, because it's not just Abbott Labs, but Abbott Labs is a huge part of it, and I just wonder how long it'll take for them to get their lab practices into line where they can begin manufacturing again.
They have to figure out what the issue is. I don't know. I can't speak on baby formula. I can give you an example from the meatpacking industry. There was a, obviously Upton Sinclair and the whole, the jungle and the whole issue of the meatpacking industry, it got heavily regulated to stop cross-contamination and all this other stuff. And so they had, because that cross-contamination, you know, you get those chicken germs on those beef germs or vice versa, and that's a deadly lunch for anybody. So you have to be very careful.
Absolutely.
So they had a regulation that said, you know, if you're in a big meatpacking plant, the table for processing chicken has to be so many feet away from the table processing beef or pork or anything else. And that worked for quite a few years. And then in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a rash of problems found coming out of one of the meatpacking plants in New York, where there was cross-contamination and people were getting very sick because they were getting, you know, it's like a Reese's peanut butter cup, but the worst way. You know, they're getting a little chicken in their beef or a little beef in their chicken somehow, and the diseases, the bacteria are cross-contaminating and making people very sick. And that basically, after all the investigation, and I'm going to make these numbers up, the regulation said they had to be like 8 or 10 feet apart, these tables, to stop cross-contamination. The bacteria just found a way to evolve to spread more than 10 feet or that distance. So all they did was increase the distance by 50%, and then the problem went away. But it's because the bacteria evolved and found a way around the system. And that's, if you're in the bio business like I am, that's just what they do. It's just like trying to stop water leaking through an earthen dam. If the water's going to find a way to leak out eventually, just like with that ton of sludge you got over in West Virginia somewhere, that will break at some point
it's not if it's when.
Yeah, and that's sort of the same system when working with bacteria. It's, you can try to keep the safest system you can, but when people are tired, people are overworked, bacteria has evolved, something gives, and as soon as there's a crack in the defenses, those buggers will find a way through, which again is why anyone that's in that world is very scared of COVID. And because, yes, it keeps increasing contagiousness, and it's not as severe, but it can, very rarely does a mutation become less contagious. But it can become more severe. Something could happen. And we, like I said, it's the mutation lottery. We could hit a jackpot of a variant that is our worst nightmare, or goes into jumps to another animal and decimates the pig and the pork industry or the chicken industry. At a time we're already having problems with supply chains of other food like baby formula. There's just, you know, there's some not good scenarios that can happen.
That's frightening. And of course, you know, I look at corporate America, Paul, and like you said, you know, meat problems, you know, people dying from tainted peanut butter, for God's sakes, or E. coli on the lettuce. And basically what that means, you know, when you've got E. coli on lettuce, that means somebody's been, and we're talking about, you know, E. coli 157H7, which is, well, you know, they're either...
Some mammal shit in the lettuce somehow.
Yes, yes, thank you.
That's what that means to me.
Yeah, I was struggling.
A mammal shit on the lettuce. Could be a squirrel, could be a person, could be someone that was at their house and cleaned the cat box and didn't wash their hands and came into work. Who the heck knows?
Right, and you know, chicken processing is a horror. And so yeah. Go ahead.
One of the things that we don't fully grasp with bacteria, not viruses, but bacteria, is something that it taught me in my very first microbiology class, which is under optimum conditions. So these conditions did not exist. But if you made the perfect environment for a certain bacteria, which is expensive and hard to do, but not impossible, the bacteria, one bacteria, can go from one bacteria to 1 trillion bacteria in 24 hours.
Good God, wow.
They're that fast. That is, and by the way, you, Robin, and myself and whatever, they're, you know, and any human on the planet, based on their mass, is roughly 1 to 3 trillion cells. So one bacteria can roughly have the same mass gain if given enough food and opportunity and growth and waste removal and temperature and everything to basically transform into the mass of roughly an 8-year-old child in 24 hours from one bacteria.
Jesus.
So that's how fast they can potentially grow. So you just need 3 or 4 bacteria particles in the cells on somewhere to rub up on some lettuce and you're in business. And in a matter of the hours it takes that lettuce to go from the factory to the store is more than enough time for 3 to become 3 million or 3 billion. But usually when it hits the billions, that's when you start smelling like, oh, that's rotten. It's the millions that kill you. because that's where you can't quite detect the smell of them, but there's enough of them to overpower your immune system and your defenses and your stomach acids and all that other stuff.
Wow.
The virologists and the microbiologists and the little itty bitty biology folks really do take away the take the little ray of effing sunshine at parties and stuff. No one talks to us. We're kind of like the proctologists of the medical field. No one really wants to talk to us because it's all scary and all not good to, while you're having important wine and cheese conversations at fundraisers and stuff. So what do? I work with the disease. Oh, that's nice. What do you do when you're not working with disease? Because I don't want to talk about that.
It, right. Or they take a couple of steps back. Oh, how nice for you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Nothing will get you more room, more personal bubble space than saying I work in a level 4 biohazard lab environment at USMRIT or CDC, and I constantly handle smallpox and Ebola. Well, I'm going to go wash my hands now after just shaking, meeting you. Have a nice day. So. And then
you sound like that's something you've actually experienced. The others?
No, not personally. I'm a biochemist. My expertise is more on drugs. I'm the drug guy. Everyone wants to talk to me. Everyone wants to say, hey, can I take this drug with this drug? And I'm like, A, I'm not a pharmacist. B, I'm not your doctor. And C, don't do it. But D, yeah, you'll be fine. On a chemical level. So the other thing I know it's a short break, and I just wanted to get this other thing out there. I've been hearing your what's the right word? Wrestling with you're experiencing your rage and your fury about the Roe v. Wade decision.
Yes.
Or at least the leak.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely not, as a man, going to talk about Roe v. Wade. I'm mostly focusing on your anger and fury. As someone who's dealt with anger and rage problems their whole life, everyone says stuff, and I was told that, like, managing your anger and your rage and your fury is you have to have a toolbox full of tools, and different tools work on different situations. And just like everyone's toolbox, there are some tools in a toolbox, if you buy like a set of tools, that you never touch because you never use them in your day, in your life, for what you're working on. So not every tool works for every situation, but I would like to share a tool with you and the Horn community that has helped me out a lot. And I picked it up from, oddly enough, the Odysseus miniseries with Amanda Sante and Isabella Rossellini from the 1990s, where Odysseus says, to be angry is easy. To be angry at the right person for the right reasons at the right time is the difficulty. And I find myself, when I'm super angry, to ask questions, am I really angry at this person? Yes, no. No, then don't yell at them. Yes, then am I angry at them for a good reason? Yes or no. And then is this the right time to be angry at them? No, the kids in the room, let's not just yell. And so I find kind of lining those up help me, because there's so much, I can't think of the right word. Shyness away from being angry. Being angry is a bad thing. Being angry is not okay. You know, especially if you're trying to be nonviolent or a pacifist like yourself. Being angry is okay. Anger is simply the reaction that something has injured you physically or emotionally. And sometimes we lash out at the wrong thing, but it doesn't take away from the fact that you've been injured physically or emotionally or spiritually, which is why it can be super frustrating when someone dismisses your anger because they're dismissing your pain. You know, don't get so angry about Roe v. Wade. It won't affect you, Robin. Why so mad? Because you've been injured. It's the equivalent of, you know, being kneecapped with a golf club and you're lipping around and someone's just saying, hey, can you walk right? The same process. So that might be one of the reasons you're so angry and wrestling with this, but try that tool and see if it works for you.
Okay. That actually sounds helpful, because you know, there's anger and it's anger in combination with the sense of helplessness. It's anger and yeah. knowing you can't do a damn thing about it. It's like being beaten. It's like being beaten while you're tied to a chair.
Yeah, there's a lot of anger tied to that. Forgive me, there's some ambient noise. I'm outside, but to finish this up before my break's over. I find that people, men, women, you know, stick your genderless pronoun in there, whatever works. People in general, the dividing line of allowing someone to empathize truly with someone that suffered because they're dealing with Roe v. Wade, or they've had been sexually assaulted, or been raped, or been beaten, or whatever, is if you've experienced personally powerlessness on some level, where you have, you know, whether it's been pinned down by people while they're kicking you and spitting on you, or sexually assaulted, or whatever, that feeling of powerlessness where all your skills, all your abilities, all your strength, all your smarts can't get you out of a horrible situation, and you simply have to endure it. Much like the story you told about Ferg being beaten up at middle school or high school, one incident where he was kicked on the ground repeatedly while they were screaming, I believe, faggot at him. I could be wrong on the details.
No, that was it. Yep.
That's a moment of powerlessness where you're just at the mercy of someone or some group that does not give a shit about you. And anyone that's experienced that does never want anyone else to feel that way again. Or they internalize it and become a-holes and want other people to feel that way because they felt it. And it gives them some sort of unhealthy catharsis that they should not do. And the theory for me comes from, I know that feeling, not to the depths of rape or sexual assault or dealing with whether or not you should abort a child, but I don't want anyone to feel that way because it's...
Well, I mean,
it's one of the worst feelings ever. It's horrible.
As I said a few minutes ago, before you came on, you know, this didn't happen to me, but it's in my life. And I've seen what it does. What you know, like forced birth does. I mean, I can't imagine that any woman who has ever gone through a stillbirth wouldn't say, you know, if only it had never happened. Because the trauma that comes with going through the hell of labor, and all the hormones that come with it, and then no baby. That's an unimaginable torment to me.
No, and especially in the right wing structure where your worth is as a woman is defined by your ability to bear children. The fact that you can't bear it, you have to go through all that plus the societal issue of not being able to do it, depending on what kind of culture you live in. It's awful. There's nothing good about it. All you can do is hope that you have friends and family that can be supportive to get you through the tough time.
And, you know, Republicans don't care. Sure. I mean, they just don't. Because they're a bunch of religious maniacs, none of this enters into their contemplation. You know, Jesus suffered on the cross, Jesus suffered on the cross, so you can suffer in the stirrups.
Yeah. Just my own personal note before I go my break ends. I've always found Republican ideology similar to the chemical equation of the inert gas law. And basically, the inert gas law basically states, it's an equation that basically tells you at a certain temperature and a certain pressure and a certain amount of gas, it will take up this volume, no matter what type of gas you have. It's just a behavioral thing, and it's a really good equation. But it breaks down and doesn't work when you start getting to extreme pressures and extreme temperatures. And it just doesn't work in exceptional cases. It absolutely works against it and can lead you the wrong way. And all the Republican ideas sound good, like, hey, let's not have innocent babies be aborted. But that is on the ideal situation where everyone's in a kumbaya land, you know, holding hands and everything's fine. That doesn't include high pressure, high temperature situations like incest, rape, ectopic pregnancy. And they just don't adjust the exceptions because everything's got to be simple. Everything's got to be perfect. And if you just do what they do and never walk outside the lines and expand your experience and go to extreme situations, then you'll be fine, which is impossible in the life we live. And it's also not reality. It's just a reality that works in a very, very specific environment. Right. And so they're, in my opinion, their goal is to build that specific environment so that their ideology works, which is the ultimate cart before the horse, in my opinion.
Hey,
as a scientist, ideology can't define reality. Reality has to define ideology. Otherwise, you die.
And, you know, and they don't care. You know, again, the fact that they don't, the fact that the Republicans don't include consideration for the life of the mother, you know, that's the ectopic pregnancy that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, yeah. she can bleed to death in her own abdomen, no big deal. Yeah.
God's will. You know, with that, or with the general decline in health of Americans in the past few decades, preeclampsia with high blood pressure, the dangers of going through pregnancy with type 2 diabetes, the dangers of developing type 2 diabetes when pregnant, or type 1. I mean, that's a thing that can happen. And I am not an expert in pregnancy, but I know enough to know that it is not as simple as the easy bake oven 9-month process that people proclaim that it is. It's really complicated and a lot can go wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the progress of or process of human development, it's kind of, you know, it's like what you said, life finds a way, but it's brutal the ways that it finds.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is not subtle. And does not use kid gloves. But Robin, that's all my time. Unfortunately, it's really short. I got to go back in there.
I'm so glad you called in.
I can't guarantee any future submissions or calls next week. I'll try to do what I can. But like, I worked 52 hours last week.
Good,
because it's just there's that much work. Yeah.
Well, on the upside, that
I get paid by the hour.
Yeah, and that sounds like job security.
For the moment, but I am currently just in the mindset that my reality is fluid, and so is everyone else's, and anything could change at a given moment. So treasure what you have and hug 5 puppies at once. It always makes me feel better.
Oh, God, I feel better just hearing hug 5 puppies at once come out of your mouth. Yeah. All that fur and all that fuzz and all that wiggling and the cute little chirps and barks and yeah.
So Horn family, mask up, be careful. It's surging back, and even though it might not give you any symptoms and you might not even know you have it because you're asymptomatic, don't be another ticket in the mutation lottery. That's how it stops.
Exactly. Because the lottery, it's still playing the lottery. It's still buying tickets.
Have a good one, and I'll call you when I can.
Take care and be safe, Paul. Thank you for all the information. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and be safe, too.
Bye. Paul always brings such valuable information to these conversations, and I'm so, so very grateful to him. Because that was his break at work. He's going back to work and, you know, nose to the grindstone, or maybe in his case, the Petri dish or the test tube or the, well, it'd be kind of unpleasant if it was nose to the Bunsen burner, wouldn't it? Thank you, Paul. Thank you so much. Jude, appreciated your call. She said, Paul, excellent way to maneuver when emotion grips us. To understand the emotions are forceful, but as we journey through them, we need each other to ground by being listened to. Absolutely. Oh, and while we were talking, I got a note from Matt and from Darlene. Matt noting, Abbott reached an agreement this week with the FDA to reopen the Sturgis facility through a consent decree with conditions enforceable by a federal court. Under the consent decree, Abbott is required to bring in a team of independent experts to develop a plan for the Michigan plant to come into compliance with U.S. food safety laws. The company has said it can restart the plant within 2 weeks, subject to FDA approval, but it'll take up to 8 weeks for products to arrive in stores again. And, you know, I may have mentioned it, but we've got a grandbaby on the way. And I am nervous about this. And by the way, I said Darlene wrote, ABC News reporting that Joe Biden, President Biden, is invoking the Defense Production Act to deal with the baby formula shortage. That came from the White House earlier this evening. That'll allow ingredients for formula to get to manufacturers faster to help speed up production. In the White House statement, they said the president is requiring suppliers to direct needed resources to infant formula manufacturers before any other customer who may have ordered that good, directing firms to prioritize and allocate the production of key infant formula inputs will help increase production and speed up in supply chains. God, one hopes. Additionally, in his capacity as commander-in-chief, President Biden told the Department of Defense to use commercial aircraft to pick up infant formula overseas and get it onto U.S. shelves faster as the ramp up in production comes. And the funny part, not funny, about all of this is the, well, there's a human element and there's a capitalism element. Paul was talking about working hammer and tongs to make test kits because of the demand. Well, when the pandemic hit, you remember the great toilet paper shortage of 2020? God, we've been in this so long. Well, there was that was a result of panic buying. And there, it turns out, was also a little bit of panic buying going on with regard to baby formula. And so parents of small children bought up lots of baby formula. And then put it on their shelves. And then as the pandemic, not a lockdown, eased, they stopped buying formula because they were formula poor. You know, for those of you who have never used formula for baby feeding, you know, it comes in liquid form, it comes in concentrate form, and it comes in powder form. And that was one of the things that made Annette such a wonderful mommy, because she knew right away, and I remember her explaining this to me, you do not want a colicky baby. No, no, dear, we do not want a colicky baby. And as a consequence, she started all of our kids right off on soy formula, not milk-based. And they tolerated it better, less spitting up, and no, most importantly, no colic. But anyway, so parents hoarded formula, which meant that they were not steadily purchasing formula anymore. And so, and you know, we've talked about this on a number of occasions, and it's absolutely fascinating, sort of, this supply chain theory. I'm sure somebody came up with this at, like, the fucking Harvard School of Business.
Yeah.
Some MBA stands for More Bigger Assholes. What did Paul say in another call? Just-in-time supply chains is actually translates in his world to never fucking there. Well, since people had hoarded and they didn't buy, the companies ramped down production because people were buying less formula. And then the Abbott Labs thing struck, because apparently that plant was just filthy, because I guess some, you know, some accountant somewhere said, we can save about 16 digits out from the to the right of the decimal point of a penny per ounce if we slow production down. And our share prices will go up. Yay! Ta-da! Shortage. So, in other words, it took a long time to get to get into this mess, and it may take as long to get the hell out of it. And President Biden trying to soothe angry Americans who have been deliberately angered by outfits like Fox News TV Radio Rwanda said, I know parents all across the country are worried about finding enough infant formula to feed their babies. As a parent and as a grandparent, I know just how stressful that is. And he does. And he does care. But, again, no matter how compassionate he was in his words, it won't matter to Emery and Marvelline, because they'll just go back to grunting and barking and hooting about how Joe Biden has hidden all the formula from all the parents. And along the way, you know, the, what's it called? The La Leche League. It's an organization that promotes breastfeeding, because what mamas produce in their breasts is the best thing in the world for babies. You know, as long as mama's getting a good diet, and, you know, reminds me of the story from, good God, I think it was 2004, maybe 2005, where they sampled mother's milk from California to Maine, and there was not a single sample taken that did not contain a component of rocket fuel. Yeah, of course. But it does remain a fact. I think any responsible and competent medical professional will say that breastfeeding a newborn is the best thing. You know, the colostrum has all kinds of antibodies in it to protect the newborn early on, when its immune system would otherwise be very, very weak. And that has fallen off dramatically in recent years. Probably for a variety of reasons. Part of which has to do with the barbarian nature of the way we the way we treat new parents in this country. Mom's got to get back to work. And, you know, they're still pumping and storing and, but, you know, paid parental leave, that's communism, right? Funny. The people who say it's communism, curiously enough, are the same people who say that abortion's murder and, well, you get the idea. We want you to have the baby. We don't much care how you try to feed it after the baby's born, however, because we're Republicans and we're... That's right. Christians. Oh, speaking of the Christians. And I'm going back to the phone in a sec. So there's a... there's some Catholic schools in Ohio. In particular, there's a Catholic high school called Lake Catholic High School. I don't think it's a high school built on the shores of Lake Catholic. Maybe it's in a community called Lake. I don't know. Maybe some Ohio correspondent could clear that up for us. But, well, Lake Catholic High School has a boys lacrosse team. And they were playing a lacrosse match against Orange High School. And it turns out that the bishop or the Monsignor or the 33rd degree noble lumpkin who runs Lake Catholic High School let a boy on the field to play who had a swastika tattooed on his leg. And not only did the kid with the swastika tattooed on his leg get to play, the kid with the swastika tattoo on his leg hurled ethnic slurs while he was on the field playing lacrosse for Lake Catholic High School. Now, maybe it wasn't a tattoo. Maybe it was just painted. But there's a photo, and you can see it. A student at Orange High School and a photographer for the school paper, Rachel Glazer, said, "I'm Jewish, so it hit pretty close to home." It's crazy how much anti-Semitism is on the rise. The superintendent of Orange Schools, Dr. Lynn Campbell, issued a statement. Dr. Campbell said, "It is with great sadness that I write to inform you of an incident that occurred last night on campus during the men's lacrosse game against Mentor Lake Catholic High School. Our players reported seeing a swastika painted on the leg of a Lake Catholic player, and subsequently, alumni and parents reported that a visitor was using racist slurs toward our team. I've spoken to the president of Lake Catholic, who shared that he and the diocese are aware of the magnitude of this situation. He confirmed that they're addressing the incidents, and he's very apologetic and obviously does..." That adjective's doing a hell of a lot of heavy lifting there. "Obviously does not approve of these behaviors. It is important to note that student discipline is confidential, so it's likely we will not be made aware of this player's consequences." Or if there are any consequences. Lord, you have to be carefully taught. And so, again, we're talking about a kid under 18. Let's remember, Peyton Gadron was 18 years old when he massacred 10 people of color in Buffalo, New York. Well, maybe this kid's on the way, too. Wonder if he's got an AR-15 at home. I hate Illinois Nazis. I hate Ohio Nazis, too. Oh, Robin, he's just a kid. And once again, we're back to that same place we were yesterday asking questions. How does a 17-year-old get Nazified? Bueller? Bueller? Anybody? Clue? Where's the lacrosse coach? Of course, there won't be any hue and cry from any Republicans about this because they're only interested in, they only care if maybe a trans girl plays lacrosse on the girls' lacrosse team. And by the way, I've been keeping up with it. Ohio is going full Alabama. They've got their own slate of anti-trans legislation in the state house in Columbus now. Curiously, there is no legislation in the Ohio House of Representatives addressing student athletes who wear Nazi symbols during their games.
Well, that'd violate the student's freedom of speech. But was the Nazi playing on the team that was indicated by the gender on the birth certificate?
Wow. Oh, I need to go and check, Jeremy. That's just that's too rich. Oh, there it is. Yeah, okay. A mother's love. We talked about former Family Research Council staffer Josh Duggar. See, I said that should be the first reference, and I'm following my own rule. We talked about the fact that he's due to be sentenced and faces up to 20 years for being a pedophile, an active pedophile. And, well, sentencing will be in about a week and a half, I think. He was found guilty of one count of receiving and one count of possessing child pornography. Well, various parties are filing memoranda about the sentencing. And as Jeremy points out, one of them has come from Mother Duggar. You Mother Duggar. Sorry, couldn't resist. I know everybody else. Mother Duggar! Godfrey Daniel, Mother of Pearl, Mother Duggar! Oh, I think we're going to have to start using that one just to clean the program up a little bit. You Mother Duggar! And you'll understand why when I tell you what she wrote. She asked Judge Timothy L. Brooks to take it easy on Joshy and said he's a positive, upbeat, diligent, organized, loving man and with no shame whatsoever, nor irony, a caring father. Might want to, never mind, no, don't use the hockey puck for this because you could choke. Get the vomit bucket. Joshua has a tender heart and he is compassionate toward others. If someone is having a difficult time, he is one of the first to encourage or to try to help them in a tangible way. Once again, tangible, doing a lot of work there. He's always been a positive and upbeat person. He supports his wife financially, saving money for the future and purposing not to go into debt. He's a good provider for his family, working diligently and thinking of creative ways to support and care for his wife and children. Creative indeed. By the way, it's worth remembering the prosecutor said that this was some of the most disgusting stuff they'd ever had to deal with. But of course, they're tender and delicate and dainty, Ma and Pa Duggar are. At the time that he was found guilty, they described the trial as an ordeal and said that the trial had been grievous for them. Suffer the little children to come unto me. For of them is the kingdom of God. Sick fucker. Yeah, Jeremy, with some analysis, says, cutting through all her Mother Duggar bullshit, all she's saying is he's a God-fearing and prays for people. And he takes care of his wife and kids creatively. Gotta wonder if he shared them along. They got it all. I don't know. God. By the way, we're almost 2 hours into the program, and we are at Goose Egg. About $1,600 in the fundraising goal. So that's over a week of unfunded broadcasting. On nothing but my good looks. And our subscribers. Thank you. Thank you so much. And let's run over and check in with Dave in the Blind. Hey, Dave.
Good evening, Robin. I'm reporting from the neo-Confederate state of Taliban, Indiana.
Yes.
Where the Huck and Christ flies and the stars and bars and the piss-colored snake flag are flying on in one house on the east side, and nobody wants to light a torch on those godforsaken rags because of freedom of speech. I mean, good God. These right-wing asswicks get up in the pulpits and start berating my beloved area of study, history, with their faith lines to her. This just goddamn infuriates, because when I was in college, where you really got into the subject of how to look at sources and things, you never ran into that shit in high school. That was all pre-digested for you.
Yeah.
There's no critical race theory being taught in high school or elementary school. And when they do talk about slavery or the causes of the Civil War, or the foundation of this country and its problems and its successes, you can't teach kids that, well, we've always done the right thing every time, no matter what, because that's just not the truth. They want a verbalized version of history. Everything was glorious back when. The military never made a mistake. It sort of reminds me of the 14 identifiers in fascism. They're nuts. They have absolutely gone around the bend. And listening to the program last night, I agree with you. They need a law, a federal law on the books to deal with the way racists operate in the 21st century. Because God knows if the defeated Confederates had had the internet back in the day, they'd have had claverns in Canada and all around the territories owned by the United States, because, well, I can just sit up here in my mansion and sit on my computer and have my paperwork all done for me. They are pernicious. And conspiracy theories have been part of this country from the beginning. From the various conspiracies about religious groups, including the Shakers, which ironically enough believe in celibacy, but they were investigated by various states for sexually abusing children in their care. As a matter of course, not because it was an incredible allegation. Or the anti-Masonic law. This sort of stuff has been going on as long as we've been a country. I had a friend who bought into all the inside job nonsense about 9/11. Of course, this guy also had a copy of the Turner Diary and all the rest, but swore up and down he wasn't a fascist. And what's really ironic in the goddess of irony is a good goddess. She was visited my family on many occasions. He ended up at the age of 42 taking up with my 25-year-old niece, my brother-in-law's daughter. And yet he would espouse this kind of racist nonsense. So, okay. I'll climb off the soapbox.
You're fine, Dave. You're fine.
How are you doing tonight, Bobby?
apart from that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? I'm good. It's only 82 degrees in here. I gotta go and get the stuff to get the air conditioner hooked up. In a pretty good mood, really. I've been in a good mood, except every time I open the news and didn't find out, another raft of horror and ugliness.
You know what I haven't heard a lot of since Buffalo? Boston Parrot.
You're right. I haven't heard a lot of tots and prayers either, I was thinking about that myself, I don't know if there's no tots and prayers because maybe the Republicans have finally started to, no, I can't. No, there's no tots and prayers because it's people they don't do tots and prayers for.
Oh, well, I have a point there, Rob. You know, this has been very difficult for me because I have lost two nephews to gun violence. One was self-inflicted, one was a murder. And so when racially motivated murders especially occur, I get really, really upset. You can imagine me hopping up and down the wheelchair, hearing the blind. Thankfully, I've got solid floors, so I don't have to worry about breaking through in the basement. But Yeah, I have to pretty much stay away from people, as Tom said. But I think that we need an updated a law that takes into account things like the internet, that takes into account self-radicalized. It takes into account how an 18-year-old can get a weapon that was designed for people who can't really shoot. The AR-15 puts enough lead downrange that you don't have to be a good shot to hit stuff. And there are rules for if, well, what about traditional hunting? In most states, there's a limit on the size of the clip that can be placed in the rifle, in the hunting rifle, to give the animal a decent chance of avoiding instant death by being made into Bambi birds by the firearm. You don't go hunting with an AR-15 unless you're hunting two-legged varieties. And I'm not talking chickens and ducks.
No.
They're made for people who cannot shoot. So all these big God-fearing fundamentalists who go out and spend, you know, $1,500 to $2,500 on an AR-15 and all the beautiful accessories. Those are not shooting. Those are, I want to show that my store-bought phallic symbol is bigger than yours. And that's all it is.
You know, you hate to make something so reductive as a dick measuring contest, but isn't that often the case?
Right, and I know exactly where our little Maddie Cawthorn's going to get his next job. Yeah, he's going to go to Lindsey Graham and to Mike Pence. And he's going to get a referral to the Log Cabin Republicans because folks. But, you know, I'm with you, buddy. Just come on. It's okay. You know. And is it just me or is it? I'm glad that a lot of progressives did well in their races.
Yeah, look at Fetterman. I mean, granted, Anna Navarro was complaining. I guess you could call it complaining that the so-called middle of the road, and she acts like it's a bad thing that milquetoast, lukewarm Democrats are having a hard time. Yeah, this is not a time for milquetoast and lukewarm.
Oh no, you got to show the American people that you have a passion for what you're talking about, for what you're advocating. I've said many times, even on this program, you have to advocate as if the right you're fighting for, you already have. Whether that's marriage rights, whether that's civil rights, whether that's rights due to physical ability or lack thereof. If there's one thing I've learned over the 57 years I've been alive, is that you must advocate for yourself constantly. I've done that since I was a small child. When I was 6 years old, I went to a Catholic school. And the principal, who was also my first grade teacher, assigned one of the boys to get my crutches for me, hold my crutches for me at night so that I could get in and out of the queue. That's not a bad job, but I was taught by my parents to pick my own crutches. And it's 6 years old, I got quite upset with her. And she let me go on for about 10 minutes. And then she said, David, I know you can get it. I know you can get your own crutches. Everybody knows you can get your own crutches. Good thing you do get your own crutches. So I wonder, did you let me allow the other kids to get the crutches for you so that they learned that it's good to help others? And I thought about that for a second. And that made it all better. But she explained to me why she did it. Not that she didn't believe I couldn't do it, but that she was trying to teach the other kids something. So we have to approach this. What can we learn? And as long as we're taking bets on who needs it, or Supreme Court opinion, I think that might have come from Alito himself. And I'll tell you why. Because with all the blustering of old balls and stripes, any investigation will go to the Chief Justice first. Any result of any investigation will go to John Roberts. And it will be up to him whether the rest of the court hears about it or whether it's released to the public. But my money is on Alito because he is the kind of shit bird that is just twisted up enough to do it. You know, for all its protestations and not being a political body, it's been acting like a political body for the last 60 years.
Well, I saw an article the other, and let me see if it'll pop in my notifications here. Just a sec. Sorry about this. There it is. It's from Politico, and it's actually worth a read. It's an opinion piece. Samuel Alito, One Angry Man. And the tease for it was, it's not his legal theories that explain Samuel Alito. It's his anger. And Aziz Hook, who wrote the piece, basically says that he's not just a conservative, he's not a consistent originalist in the vein of Scalia or Thomas. The key to understanding Alito is not judicial philosophy or ardent conservatism, it's his anger, an anger that resonates with the sentiments of many voters, especially white and male ones, who feel displaced by recent social and cultural changes. If you want to understand what to expect from the post-Roberts court, paying attention to that anger pays dividends. Again, it's at Politico. And it's worth the read.
Oh, goodness. And if there is a Republican in office when Roberts leaves the court, he's a candidate for that job. Unfortunately, because I don't think Thomas would get it because of his age. Frankly, I think Thomas would be in peace. Because he is not acting with good behavior. He should have deceived himself in any of this shit that his wife is involved in. And how much do you want to bet that even if a law was passed requiring the Supreme to adhere to the same canon of ethics that any other federal judge does, that there'll be an immediate challenge to it by some right-wing legal group, and the Supremes will strike it down to merit, working backwards the way they normally do. I think we're beginning to see the stirrings of what could happen in November, because you have progressives doing well on the Democratic side, and you have the crazier than bad shit crazy ass left in the Republican Party gaining traction. People who, if possible, are crazier than Donald J. Trump. I know. It sounds weird to somebody to say that, but that there are plenty of Republicans out there who are even more bad shit crazy than he is. And that's plenty of bad shit crazy. As a matter of fact, the Republican Party should be called the Asylum Party, because the inmates are running the asylum. It's nice. But I honestly think that it was a leader, or he had one of his clerks do it.
That makes, I mean, that actually makes sense to me, Dave. It doesn't make sense that Roberts would do it. It doesn't make sense that any of the three so-called liberal justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, or Breyer, would do it. And there's no reason for the four signatories to do it. And so if you eliminate the impossible, whatever is left, however improbable, is the answer. He had a reason. He had, you know, if we treat this like the detective story that it is, Alito had a motive to do this.
Yeah, he
wants to make it impossible for those four to bail out or chicken out, because he knows that they will spend the rest of their lives as persona non grata in the circles, the fetus fetish circles that propelled them to their positions.
Because without something to operate against, they have to find something else.
I mean, a hardcore Roman Catholic like the Handmaid or Brat or Slappy does not want to even contemplate the idea that there might that they will be denounced from sea to shining sea by misogynistic probably child predator priests.
Right, see, you mean the bishop from one end of the country to the other.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure I was using the right homophone. My dad, back in 75, when the Right to Life Committee started really gaining traction among Roman Catholics, my dad was all in. Never mind he was well behind on his health care. He never really spent much time with us, except every other weekend. And even then, he was often off doing something else. I always wondered why he was so worried about kids that weren't even born yet and the city that he is now. Well, it's north. By and large. Frankly, by both of you. Dad was particularly virulent about it, and still is. And he was right along with Nixon and Reagan and Bush Jr. And he was kind of lukewarm on Ford, but he was. He believes in Republicans and Democrats. You know. And even the language that they used to describe their opposition was meant to make it sound bad. Every Democrat was a communist. And, you know, a Russia-loving communist. Now we have Russia loving fascists. And it's okay. It's, you know, it's like I said before, if I'd been a teacher and I'd been teaching a social studies class that he's president of the United States, if one of my scholars looked over and said Vladimir Putin, I'd have to mark it as correct. Back a couple of years ago. It's tough. And the only way we fight back is to do what we did 2 years ago. But midterm elections are notoriously lightly populated. And contrary to what some historians will tell you, this country's never had 100% voter participation. Ever. It's always been the minority of a minority that has ruled the roost. Those that can gain the franchise and then, by God, they go to exercise it. Rule over those who have the franchise but don't bother. You know, they got to wax their cat that day or something much more important.
Well, you know, I want to revisit something that you said a little bit ago, Dave. I think it's really important. We are of similar age, and talking about, you know, the Nazis. The Nazis in high schools and whatnot. You remark, you know, that shit was not in my school when I went. And as crazy as it may sound, you know, you growing up where you grew up and me growing up in Alabama, it wasn't in my school either. For all the screwed upness of Alabama, we did not have a Nazi problem.
You didn't have Mein Kampf on call in the library. Anything like that.
You know, it might have been there. I don't know. But it's just, it's a piece, it's a historical document, you know, putting that aside for a moment, what we did have, and it's this in conjunction with the internet may be at least a partial answer. What we had for my generation, you kids get off my lawn. You clouds, quit being so damn puffy. Sorry.
You're talking like a bitter old woman now.
Thank you.
You know that.
Thank you. But what we had were daddies. I mean, my parents were older. But we had daddies who had fought Nazis, or had brothers who had fought Nazis, or granddaddies and uncles who had fought Nazis, for whom the reality of what the Third Reich did was, it wasn't speculative. It wasn't something that happened a long time ago. I've only realized later in life that my father suffered from untreated PTSD that was hell for him. And they just said, you know, welcome home, glad you won the war, back to work, back down in the mines. But they had a visceral understanding of what Nazis do. And so when that generation went away, the people who did not learn the lessons and did not pass the lessons on sort of created an open space, if you will, for this shit to flourish on the internet. I mean, I will never forget the day that Ferg told me that one of his little friends, you know, that's how we talk about them, you know, one of his little friends was really into Nazis. And I stopped everything I was doing in that moment. And I said, well, we have to talk. That's not okay.
Yeah.
And went through with gory detail why it wasn't okay. But the kid never stopped being into Nazis, and then he joined the military. Ta-da!
Well,
and then at some point he became a prison guard.
Oh,
ta-da!
God. You and I benefited from one of the greatest pieces of legislation that was ever passed. And that was the GI Bill. Because the American Legion and other veterans organizations during World War II, at the height of the war, said to the Congress and to the American people, we have to do better than we did for the veterans of World War I. And so the GI Bill included things like educational grants for veterans and something called the 5220 Club. Every returning veteran was eligible for $20 a week for the first year they were out of the service to help them reintegrate into civilian society. One veteran said, that was enough for me to pay for my rent for the week and get groceries. You know. And one gentleman whose father was German and had come over from Germany looked over at his son and said, you will not accept this money because it was your duty to fight against it. Because his father didn't want his neighbors, his American neighbors, to think that he wasn't a good American because he'd come from Germany. And that man hated him, absolutely despised him. So we grew up with, you and I grew up with teachers that had been taught under the GI Bill. And they would often talk about their experiences in the military, in Europe, during the war, especially the history teacher. And they would say, you know, they would say the part that would now be illegal in Alabama and places like that, and explain to us why it was so evil, why Nazism was so evil, why we had to fight in Europe and in the Pacific. I had a friend who was 14 years old when the war broke out. He's a tall farm boy, lied to the Marine recruiter and became a Marine and fought in the Pacific. And I looked at him, and he served in the Marine Corps until the end of the Korean War. And I asked him, I said, Bert, why did you volunteer so quickly? He says, I didn't want it to be over before I got there. That's an honest 14-year-old answer.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was one of those guys, but he'd see violence in the neighborhood. He goes, I never saw it this bad in the Pacific. And that's the only time I ever heard him comment about his service in the Pacific. You know, unfortunately he died. I refer to him as Christine's Marine boyfriend. He'd always flirt with her, tease her, joke with her. And his wife was 6 years older than he was. And one day, he gave Christine a hug around the shoulders and told his wife, this is my girlfriend. His wife, without missing a beat, said, honey, if you want him, you can have him. yeah, it was just, they were great. They were a great couple. But he was a real character. And you and I grew up around people like that, you know, where we learned at the knee of the people that were there that was not okay. With this idea that, you know, and my friend who had the printer diary and all that, he was several years younger than me. You know, like I was in my 50s and he was in his mid-40s. That thing was younger than me. And just that 10-year gap, you could tell that his education was lacking. Because my grandfather had served in the army in Venezuela, guarding the oil fields. And people don't realize how important that was, because if the Japanese who attacked Venezuela on the Pacific side, they could have gotten all the oil they wanted. And conversely, if the Axis, the European powers, the Germans specifically, had attacked on the Atlantic side, then they could have also gotten access to oil and rubber and vital war materials. And there's only one book I've ever seen on the war, on World War II in Venezuela. We don't think of South America as being a vital front in the war. This was an actual world war that covered everything. Whether they were neutral countries or not. And you haven't seen the kind of galvanization of countries against other countries like that since then, the closest thing would be the world's reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or its latest invasion of Russia. Because, as far as I'm concerned, Crimea was illegally annexed, and it only stopped when force is applied to somebody like Putin. And eventually, I'd say within 2 years, this could turn into a clusterfuck of the deepest proportion. But Rand Paul, the quasi-libertarian ophthalmologist,
did you say quasi?
Yeah, because I thought...
Yeah, he's a libertarian when it suits him, right?
Well, I've talked to libertarians who look at a guy like Rand Paul and go, he's just a goddamn obstruction. You know, or they believe in small government. They believe in getting the government out of your bedroom or what you need or whatever. And, you know, there are some of those positions I can adhere to. Some of them I think are just foolish. Like, well, we got to have a small enough government to drown it. No. No, government has a purpose. We organize in government because that's how civilization works. You got to have somebody organizing this. Good or nothing good stuff. And that goes for democracies or empires, monarchies, anything in between. You do not live in a vacuum, contrary to what Rand Paul and his cranky racist daddy believe. I think it was from Borat or one of them, Sacha Baron Cohen had put a fast one on. Rand Paul's daddy. Oh no, it's Bruno. The movie Bruno, where he's playing a gay German traveling through the United States, and he flirted with Ron Paul, and boy, Paul ended up hightailing it out of the room just as fast as he was willing to carry him. And I thought, that's brilliant. That's just fucking brilliant. But this is all gonna. You're looking at another 50 years of fighting over women's rights, at least.
No, no. Hold on. I don't think I'm gonna push back there. There's no. There's no end point at the fight for women's rights. Because they, you know, believe them when they tell you, right, Dave? And they have said that they will never, 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 never stop trying to reduce women to sub-citizens.
Well, hell. Robin, my own father, when I was 12 years old, that would have been 1977, when the idea of marital rape became a common talking point, where you actually heard it publicly talked about on the news, on the Sunday news shows. And my dad asked me at 12, how a man, a husband, could rape his wife. Now, you and I both know that not only is it physically possible, but it was common practice. Men of my dad's generation to think like that, moderating views a little bit. But this medieval attitude of, well, it's your fault you got pregnant, it's been there for centuries, because there was a medieval belief that you could not get pregnant if you did not enjoy the sex. In other words, it was the idea that the woman had to gain pleasure in order to get pregnant. And it was a way of justifying blaming the woman for whether or not they bore sons, even though science later taught us that, well, let's say Henry was a girl maker, you know, and those medieval attitudes are with us to this present day. So you get Republicans. Now, the human body can shut that down if it's a real race. That's where this comes from. That comes from centuries of this kind of bullshit. And I doubt that it clears up in my lifetime or in my great nephew's lifetime, and he's only four. But I think if we don't get out and fight, and I mean in the street, knocking on doors, getting people registered to vote, helping the disabled get to the polling places, which oddly enough, they're trying to make illegal in certain states where you can't drive people to the polls. And that's aimed squarely at things like polls to the polls and assisting disabled people from exercising the franchise. I've had so many accessibility problems, there have been times I've had to request an absentee ballot. But then I got my ballot, my voter eligibility challenged by the state if I did not send in paperwork proving that I lived where I said I lived. I never sent that paperwork in because it was on a postcard, not even sealed in an envelope. So all my publicly identifying information is out there for any Tom, Dick, or Harry to get their hands on. The assault is violent, and we, by God, had better start fighting that. And I don't mean playing patty cake. I was surprised to see that Chuck Schumer got a spine this week. You know, blaming Rupert Murdoch and the Fox Tour and outlets like that. And to show you the mechanisms this guy used, there used to be a limit on the number of television stations and radio stations and newspapers that one person can own in any market. Well, Rupert Murdoch and his infinite wisdom and bankrolls of money, petitioned the Congress to make an exception for him, and they did, and that effectively broke that, so that he began getting a consolidation of media companies that he got today. All of the small mom-and-pop newspapers that they used to have. Hell, my hometown of Muncie, Indiana, had two newspapers. One published in the morning and one published in the evening. But now I think they've only got one. And that's the kind of thing, if you're going to limit the date, you limit the sources. I mean, I've heard you talk about your parents reading the newspaper to the breakfast table.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
It's where I fell in love with newspapers.
My grandparents, my dad's parents, were such avid readers that the Herschel and Mildred Shaw Memorial Library is any bathroom in any of our family houses that have newspapers and magazines next to the toilet on a chair where the little ones can read the funny papers or can read the headlines. I mean, I learned to read looking at the Sunday Funnies, reading the Peanuts comic strip, like the front of the comic page. And, because I knew the characters, and so I wanted to know what they were saying, and I that's how I learned to read. That's how we all learned to read. Every kid in my family. And it was not unusual for us to be sitting there for an hour because, and this is the funny thing, they lived in a large house that had one bathroom. It was upstairs. It was an older house. It had been a parsonage back in its early life. But then my grandparents bought it and raised 13 kids. Well, not all at once. I mean, by the time my Aunt Paulette, the youngest, was born, my Aunt Eva, who's their oldest, was out of the house and married and had a baby on the way. There was a picture of my grandmother and my Aunt Eva standing back to back, both of them just as big as houses, and my grandfather just giggling like a lunatic. Because he thought this was such a great picture. He had a picture of his child and grandchild in the same shot. He thought it was great. Both my grandmother and my aunt hated that picture, and it seriously disappeared. I never thought. I've seen just about everything else that was ever taken in my family. Never saw that. And my aunt ever, who is my godmother, told me why. She said, Mom and I made sure that every one of the copies got them this year. So,
well, you know, you have absorbed a lot of wisdom in your time.
And it's been a hard one. It's been a hard one. I mean, that's what I'm going to be like 40 years from now. When I'm nearly 100, and my niece's little boy, now he's having his children, family. No, your great great uncle David has a lot to say. He should listen to it. So I'll gently clean my hearing aids, turn them up, and tell the kids the story. Because remember, the story is the biggest part of history. And historians tend to be the gossip of the academic. Anything that happened in the past, there's always some gossip. You know, whether this happened or whether it didn't, it wasn't attributable to somebody. And the further you get out from it, the more outlandish details sometimes. I mean, I wouldn't doubt that in 100 years, if the Republicans have their way, there'll be no mention of slavery in the United States. And to me, that's an academic crime. That's pure and simple malfeasance.
Yeah.
And if you love facts, and I know if you being here in the Horn Family Community Congregation do, and you enjoy history and knowing what happened and the truth about what happened, and that changes over time because more stuff comes to light. So when you hear them go, oh, that's revisionist history, I hope to God if I've got new information that can be shown, hopefully through primary sources, that, yeah, what we talk about a certain individual historically or not changes. It's happened with Thomas Jefferson. There was a time you would have never heard about Sally Hemings unless you were doing a deep dive into his past. And then it would have been written off as a smear campaign on his political opponent's part. But archaeology and other disciplines and other things that were written at the time have proven what happened at Monticello. And it is now accepted that yes, in fact, he did rape Sally Hemings. Although he did not himself, he considered himself a rapist. But you can't say something like that now, according to some states. This is where I think our education system is falling down, and it's not the educator's fault. I've talked to my sisters and a teacher for nearly 30 years, and she and I are in agreement. She said, David, if I started teaching now, I wouldn't be in the profession. And she teaches third grade. And she came to me one day and said, ask my opinion on some books that I would recommend for one of her young scholars who was reading at a high school level. I said, well, what kind of books is he interested in? He said, oh, he really likes the, what is it called? Percy Jackson. So,
right.
You know, he's. And I said, introducing to Ursula K. Le Guin, the Ursi Trilogy, and J.R.R. Tolkien, even The Hobbit. And she goes, The Hobbit? I said, yeah. I said, Sister Mary Steffen, the sixth grade teacher at St. Mary's, gave me her hard copy. Her hardback copy of it over Christmas break one year, thinking I might enjoy it. And I did. And I was very careful with that book because it was the first time an adult had given me one of their personal books. And I didn't want to damage Christmas book because he entrusted it to me. So I would go in and I would wash my hands and I would dry them very carefully before I even touched. You know, I was very careful. I was about 8 years old. But she thought that I would enjoy that. I did. And it worked for me a love of that kind of writing for the rest of my life. These are the kinds of opportunities that the Republicans are robbing our children and our grandchildren of, because they've got some ideological sense that we're out to get them. First of all, I think they need a lot of Prozac. But that's just me. I think the medical intervention might be called for.
Thorazine, maybe?
Oh, if only we could make that much Thorazine, Robin. You know, however, I think President Biden, in the effort to good mental health, could sign an order to increase the production of psychotropic drugs across the board and make them cheaper and more widely available to psychiatrists so they could treat their patients. And I honestly think there ought to be a system like they have for the ROTC, where you sign a contract with the federal government to be a practicing physician for 4 years in an underserved area of the country, then the federal government will pay for your medical school thing. And Rand Paul would be up in arms about the cost, but not the effect. The effect would be like the effect would be like communities in Indiana or West Virginia or Georgia or anywhere else in the country, Alaska, would have competent medical care, including psychiatric care, which psychiatric care is medical care. You cannot separate the mind from the body. Although several Republicans have proven me wrong on that, since most of them are out of their minds. And haven't seen that they've actually received. I had a teacher once who said, when the Lord was handing out brains, he thought he said brains, and you've been on the wrong track ever since.
The way I heard that was when the Lord was passing out brains, you thought he said trains and said, I want to steal one.
And that was a teacher who was a Army Air Corps veteran from World War II, and they had run short of assistance for hangmen. And they were hanging a man for murder and rape of a French soldier, an American soldier. Now, this guy didn't have any training as a hangman, so they made him an assistant to the guy who's actually putting the rope over the guy's neck. And he said, well, what do I get out of it? They said, we'll give you a weekend pass in Paris for this one hanging. And he said, I did it. He's going to pass up a weekend in Paris. You know. He's also the guy who, he's a science teacher who got Air Force survival films and showed them on Friday because he had access to them and thought that we would benefit from learning about the natural world and how to handle ourselves in a situation where you might have to actually survive. So he showed us these four Air Force survival training things. I had a very unusual childhood, I understand.
That becomes apparent with every call, Dave, and I mean that in a good way. But I gotta I gotta get out of here because time's up. And you have yourself a good evening. Tell the boys down. Tell the boys down at the shop not to slack.
Well, you know, with so many Republicans jumping up on crosses these days, oh my God, I thought I would be able to take a rest after Easter. Oh no. No. There's been enough cross jumping now that I've actually got to send guys home on a 3-day weekend every other week just so they can get a little bit of rest. It's amazing, but I'll discuss that more on the next call, Robin.
All right, Dave, that'll be fine. And please give our warmest, most loving regards to Christine.
I will. And everybody in the horn, drop Robin a couple bucks if you can.
Well, and thank you to Jeremy. Jeremy made sure we didn't have a goose egg. We're down to $15.90. Thank you, Jeremy. And thank you. And thank you for your kind encouragement.
All right. I'll talk to you later, Robin. Thanks.
All right. See you, Dave. Bye.
Bye.
Our buddy Dave in the Blind out in the far reaches of Calabandiana. A couple of notes coming in. Lady B, earlier you mentioned that a school allowed a boy with a swastika tattoo to play on the field. Dude, there was a black boy with dreads who wasn't allowed to wrestle. You mean to tell me his dreads were more offensive than that? Sky's green, grass is blue, black is white, and we all eat our corn up and down. I know. Oh, I mean, he's just confused. Why? He's just confused. He doesn't understand what that symbol means. Horse shit, he doesn't. And when we were talking about World War II vets and the like, Ron and Raleigh wrote and said, G.I. Bill, guess who didn't get any? We know who didn't get any. We can't teach that in school because it'll make white children sad. The daintiness, the delicate daintiness of white children and white children's parents and white children's grandparents, and it's they don't want the white children to learn about what the awful shit that the white children's grandparents, grandparents, and great-grandparents did. That's what that is. And I'm sorry I didn't get to it while I had him on the line. He was on such limited time. Todd had an observation and asked me to ask Paul. So, Paul, if you're listening to the the archive, if you could find a moment, maybe respond. Todd says, the high transmissibility is par for the course for a successful virus. We should all recognize this. The next stage will be a much more serious infection. The virus is developing a memory in its genetic structure for how to usually infecting as many hosts as possible before it mutates again to be much more serious. Seems quite obvious for a novel virus. Many people here have a low, subdued cough and sniffles. It's just a matter of time. At least we know masks help to mitigate this natural progression. I also have worked in a lab, so please ask Paul what he thinks about my assessment. I'm guessing he's going to agree. And Todd adds, your program is a... Yes, I understand the usage. Public service. Thank you, Todd. And thanks to Kevin. Kevin with a lovely note just a moment ago. Said, what an amazing show, Paul and Dave. I thought so, too. And I'm glad that others do, that you do as well. Ron and Raleigh adds, remember, not all white people are Nazis. But all Nazis are white people. Meanwhile, down in Georgia, in Floyd County, a group of black students were suspended for wearing BLM shirts while a group of white students waving Confederate battle flags and yelling racial slurs managed to avoid punishment. Must be all that critical race theory those black kids are learning. Oh, I'm sure it is. Exactly. Thank you, Dave. Astute observation. different Dave. The authorities in Germany would not have permitted a kid with a Nazi tats to attend, let alone compete in a scholastic contest. It would have been against the, I mean, it's against the freaking law, and yet somehow or another, Germans are still managing to be free without, at least the Nazis had to go to the trouble of renaming themselves. But Nazi is as Nazi does. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the things, I let things get to me, and I shouldn't, but it's the fact that this shit doesn't get to us that gets us to where we are. The line in the story about the Nazi lacrosse player notes that they didn't know if it was a tattoo or if it was drawn on. And I think there are compelling arguments to be made for the drawn-on possibility to be worse. You know, it's pretty well, in the photo that I have here, it's pretty well up his calf, his right calf. And he's wearing socks. You know, the coach could have said, if it was a tattoo, the coach could have said, listen, kid, who is, of course, nameless, kind of opposed to that, too. You can wear some of those cute little ooh-woo stripy socks the trans cat girls wear. You want to have a Nazi tattoo. But then there's the equally horrifying idea that it was drawn on. That he knew he was going to be going and playing against a public school where there might be some black kids or some Jewish kids. Because, remember, it goes hand in hand with the fact that he was hurling racist epithets and slurs. I guess some people could say, you know, with everything else going on in the world today and in our country, that this is just, you know, this is just a little, but no, it's a goddamn, it's a fucking Burma Shave sign. People need to know what the hell's going on in the minds of the people who run Lake Catholic, Mentor Lake Catholic High School. I hope this gets some damn legs. Anyway, thank you. Thanks for joining in this evening. Thanks to our PayPal and Patreon subscribers. Thank you, Jeremy, a la carte contributor. Thanks to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in the program in whatever manner you so choose. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Brother Bishop Steve. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia, and now a union shop. Please stay safe. Take Paul's advice and warnings as seriously as he has made them. Get your booster. You too, Robin. Wear your masks. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Use your hand sanitizer. Maintain your social distance. And if you happen to see some little 24-year-old dude who's a, yeah, well, it was the Republican elders, the ones that invited me to the coke-fueled sex orgies, that attacked me. Well, avoid little Maddie, who, by the way, has officially shut down his pack now. As Kevin in Massachusetts told me, George Conway observed, cut! That's a wrap! Avoid him like the plague!
Because he is.
And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Later.